You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 1976, a killer who called himself the Son of Sam shot and killed a half dozen people and wounded as many more in New York City. During his crime spree, the madman left bizarre letters mocking the police and promising more deaths. After months of terrorizing the city while garnering front page headlines and international attention, a man named David Berkowitz was arrested. He confessed to the shootings, claiming to be obeying a demon that resided in a dog that belonged to his neighbor Sam. Among the alleged victims was Carl DeNaro. On the night he was shot, DeNaro was hanging out with some friends at a bar when he met up with a woman named Rosemary Keenan. The couple left the bar and went to Keenan's car for some privacy. However, a few minutes later, the windows of the car exploded as DeNaro was shot in the head by an unseen assailant. Miraculously, DeNaro survived the attack when Berkowitz was arrested. He was charged with trying to kill DeNaro. However, there was a twist. Although he confessed to the other shootings after his conviction, Berkowitz denied attacking DeNaro. Now, after years of research, DeNaro is convinced that Berkowitz was telling the truth and that someone else tried to kill him. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Son of Sam and Me: The Truth About Why I Wasn't Shot, by David Berkowitz, with my special guest, investigator and author, Carl DeNaro. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Carl DeNaro.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for this. First off, you talk about in the book, before we get to the fateful day, obviously, that you became inextricably involved with the Son of Sam story and also this case, you give credit to your daughter, Casey. So many years later, your daughter, how was she an influence? What happened and why in this project that she had as a film student, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I've batted around an idea of writing a book for many, many years, but I never really felt I had a story that other people would be interested in. Along about 2015, my daughter was a film student at the time, had to produce a student thesis film, and she decided to do a story on me. So through her interviewing me and my friends, my family, a lot of questions that never really were asked of me or I really thought about came up and got me thinking. By the time she was done with the script, I realized that I did have a story and I did have a book. She eventually finished the film, and it's a short film, 16 minutes, called Carl, very original, and
right.
And it went on to win a few awards. She won the New York Women's in Film Award, TV Emerging Female Filmmaker Award, and she won a student grant from the National Board of Review. Mm-hmm. I was also in the movie as a Detective Blues, who is obviously a real character. So that was kind of cool,
right,
to get my face on camera.
Yes. You said, too, that this book was this is an incredible book project to endeavor to do, and it was a little more difficult than you even might have thought. Tell us about the help you got from author Brian Whitney.
Sure. So, yeah, the book was difficult for me to write on a few levels. First off, being I never wrote a book before, and I took a few writing classes that my daughter signed me up for, And I wrote a little bit, and I said, "Oh, this is cool. I can do this." And when I started writing the book, I was lost. So a mutual friend who actually published a book told me about Brian, and I contacted Brian Whitney and told him my story, and we met and we hit it off and we became writing partners. And the process basically was, I would do the best I could. I'd write 5, 6, 7, 10 pages and send it to Brian, and Brian would, smooth everything out and, make my 10 pages into 20 or 30 pages. And this process took close to a year, mostly because of me, not because of Brian.
Right. Now, with this as well, what's very important about this is a book by Maury Terry, who becomes a friend, and we'll be talking about extensively about Maury Terry's influence in this and your friendship and the investigation that you both undertook to find out the truth that now has come to light in this book, Son of Sam and Me. Let's talk about what you're not trying to sell us on in this book, but also what was uncovered when you read Maury Terry's book, The Ultimate Evil.
Okay, so that brings me to another difficult part of writing this book. As I started writing, I realized that I wanted to tell my story and how it affected my life over the last 45 years. And I realized very quickly that I can't do that without explaining the Son of Sam shootings. So I started writing about each shooting, and halfway through I said, I don't want to rewrite The Ultimate Evil. That's not my goal.
Right.
So that became very difficult. Obviously it's the same case, so a lot of the same information is there, but I really wanted to write, the story from my viewpoint. I also wanted to bring forward to the general public the conspiracy theory, which has been, I don't want to say debunked, but it's been poo-pooed by the press and by the police since Maury Terry's book came out in 1987.
Right. Now, you talk about the official story, and people that follow this case know that there was an official story early on about a dog. We referenced it in the introduction. There was the official story when you were attacked, and afterwards, what was the official story that you heard following that, before they made any kind of connection to this 44 caliber killer?
Sure. The original story, I was the second, it turned out I was the second victim shot by Son of Sam, but there was no Son of Sam at the time. So it appeared to the police that it was a random shooting. And the fact that I smoked pot, I had long hair, and the girl I was with, her father was a detective, and he was assigned to my case. So his immediate reaction was, it's a drug deal gone wrong, and that certainly was not the case. But I didn't know who shot me, so I really didn't have much defense. That went on for 6 months, from October 23rd, the day I was shot, until March 10th, 1977, when Police Commissioner Codd and the mayor, Mayor A. Beam, had a press conference and said, we have a serial killer, and we were able to link five random shootings to this serial killer. So for 6 months, I was on the charts with the police department as a drug dealer.
Let's get to your particular case, because there's no way anybody can imagine how you would be depicted as a, or this case as a drug deal gone bad. I laugh at that hilarious depiction all the time. Drug deal gone bad sounds like everything was done in Mexico with a cartel or something. So let's talk about yourself. This is incredible. This is the last night before you left to join the Air Force. So tell us about this Air Force and who you were. You were long haired. You talk about smoking pot. Tell our audience who you were at this time in 1976 and this night, particular October 22nd, 1976. Who were you and what were you doing? And how did you end up meeting with Rosemary Keenan, whose father happened to be a detective?
I was 20 years old. Like I said, long hair, flannel shirts, jeans. I guess the less of the hippies from the 60s. I had dropped out of college at, a few menial jobs that I didn't really, I said, there's no future here. And I decided to join the Air Force. So, I enlisted in the Air Force and, they gave me what they call a deferred, reporting date. So I was sworn in August of 76, and my report date was October 28th of 76. And unfortunately for me and the Air Force, I was shot on the 23rd, 5 days before I was to report to basic training.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as the night of the event, I was just hanging out with my friends. We went to a party and it wasn't really that good. So we went back to the bar, Peck's Bar and Grill that we hung out at, and ran into Rosemary, who I had known from college. We've gone out on a few dates, but we certainly weren't dating. But we hung out for a little bit at the bar, had a few drinks. And then we decided to leave in her Volkswagen. And, we drove around the neighborhood. It was my neighborhood, not hers. And with no particular place in mind, unlike some of the reports that you might have heard, this was not a lover's lane type thing. It actually four of my friends lived on that block. We just wound up there. And we were there for maybe, 3, 4, 5 minutes. And next thing I know, all the glass in the car exploded, and I knew we were in trouble. It's a very surrealistic feeling, because I did not know that I was shot, but I knew we were in trouble. And, I yelled at Rosemary to start the car up, and and she did. And and I passed out for 10, 15 seconds. And she was, when I came to, she was in a tizzy because she had no idea where she was. So I directed her back to the bar and got out of the car, walked in, and this is all crazy because, I have a bullet wound in the back of my head. I have no idea how I possibly could have gotten out of the car and walked into the bar, but, I did. And, when I walked in, the guy at the door said, "You don't look good." And I said, "I don't feel good. I think the car exploded." And with that, my head went down and my long hair was holding all this blood. And at the time, I just had blood on my arms and from the glass shards. And when everyone in the bar saw that, and it's like, we got to get him to the hospital. So a friend of mine drove me to Flushing Hospital, and they took care of me there in the emergency room.
You talk about we didn't mention is that for some reason you were paranoid, but it was 76. You threw this bag of weed out the window. And this will be important a little bit later.
That, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. That'll be important later when you get too honest for your own good. So
good
now
point,
you're at the hospital here, put you on a gurney, take you an examiner. So they realize that the extent of your injury, you still don't know, but you say too that you never heard a gunshot. You just realized the glass exploded. So you never really heard a gunshot previous to that. This Marlon Hopkins is a homicide detective from NYPD. He comes to investigate, but then when they find out you're not dead, he takes off apparently. And because the doctors say you're going to be stabilized and you're going to make it through. So now what happens in terms of the police investigating this? You talked about a little while ago about how they thought it was a drug deal gone bad. So now we know, the audience knows that you threw this bag of weed out, but why on earth would they think this is a drug deal gone bad? Where do they get that idea?
Well, they got it from me, unfortunately. The next day, or actually later in the morning, Detective Keenan, Rosemary's dad, and Detective Blues, his partner, came to my room and said, you know, what happened? I said, I don't know. And he said, where did it happen? I said, 160th Street and 33rd Avenue. So they left, and they came back about an hour later and threatened to arrest me if I didn't tell them the truth. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they said, well, we went from 160th Street to 172nd Street, and we didn't find any, you know, any glass or anything.
Mm-hmm.
When they said that, it dawned on me. I said, oh, it was 159th Street, not 160th Street. And they looked at each other, and because basically, you know, they went 12 blocks in one direction, didn't think to go one block the other direction. And as a parting shot, because that's my nature, I said, and by the way, I threw a bag of weed out, so you might find that too. Which, like I said later on, that probably wasn't the smartest thing to say. But that's how they found out about the weed. And by the way, they never found the weed.
Someone did. Yeah.
Somebody did, yes.
Now, Detective Keenan, now, you say that you already knew him. You recognized him. You knew who he was. So he wasn't too happy that his daughter was involved in this situation, especially not knowing from where it came from. So he assumed that it had some kind of drug relation, or he was just looking at you. So how do they proceed with this investigation in terms of, and your participation and what you find out about this supposed 44 caliber killer?
So, basically, there is one more meeting when I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, and they came back to my mom's house where I was living and handed me a list of, I don't know, maybe 75, 100 names. And it was basically a list of people who had been arrested in my neighborhood. And I did recognize a lot of the names. Most of them were like ridiculous, you know, a stolen bike, public intoxication, a bag of weed, you know, nothing major. And I just couldn't believe that somebody I knew would shoot me. I just didn't have, first of all, I didn't live in that kind of neighborhood. It was basically an upper middle class neighborhood, that didn't really have any violence. You know, so I said, I don't think it's anyone on here. And of course there was names in there. I had no idea who they were. That was pretty much the end of that story. And to add on to that, that was pretty much the last interaction I had personally with the NYPD in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Which, it didn't really bother me back then, but it in the ensuing years, it kind of puzzled me because when they arrested Berkowitz, for example. My sister got a phone call from a reporter saying that they arrested the son of Sam, and it's this guy called David Berkowitz. And she, you know, and my sister didn't live, you know, she had her own apartment. So she called my mom's house at 2 a.m. And I, you know, in retrospect, I think it's kind of strange that I didn't get an official call from somebody in the police department saying, you know, rest easy. We caught the guy, we caught the guy that shot you.
Mm-hmm. Now, you survived, but it wasn't without some complications here. Just tell us about what they had to do before you were released from the hospital and were out of danger, per se.
Sure. Well, it was, of course, it's 76, so the, medicine's a little bit better today than it was then, but, with a head injury, there was no painkillers to be had. Was Tylenol, which really didn't help. I developed like a little bit of a nervous tic, shaking my leg up and down. And I was in pretty bad pain for, I'd say about a week, 5 days, 7 days. And then they had to come in, about a week into my hospital stay. The nurse and the doctor would come in like every other day with this huge needle and draw fluid, from the back of my skull that was building up, around my brain. And that was almost as painful as being shot. I could tell you that. I wound up staying in the hospital for three weeks. And then I was released with the instructions that I have to stay in the house. I can't go out because there's only a thin piece of skin protecting my brain. Because the bullet put a hole about the size of a 50 cent piece in the back of my head. And then they told me in January, actually January 20th, once the swelling had gone down, they would insert a plate to cover the hole that the bullet made. So that was a long 3 months.
Now, you would talk about, and you write about July 29th, the attack before yours, because you guys were second, you and Rosemary were second. But this is July 29th, 1976. Donna Loria, she's 18 years old, and her friend Jody Valenti. They're at a disco, and so a man approaches them. He pulls out a gun from a bag, crouches down, and shoots Donna, and she's instantly dead. And Valenti is shot in the thigh, and she survives. What is the description of that perpetrator at that time, July 29th, 1976?
Well, the description of the shooter pretty much, as it turned out, pretty much described David Berkowitz. They did have a suspect, Donna's ex-boyfriend, who just, I know this is bizarre, but he just happened to own a .44 caliber gun. Jeez, and they had broken up. Yeah. And they had broken up. I'm not sure if it's a few weeks or a few months, but they had broken up, and he was prime suspect. And he kind of is very strange, but he came in and out of the news very quick. He never heard of him again. They exonerated him. I guess he had an alibi, whatever, but, I always wondered, later on when they tied shootings together to a .44, why they didn't go back to her ex-boyfriend to question him again. To be honest, they might have, but I'm not aware of it. There was some other the description of from Jody, like I said, pretty much matched David Berkowitz. And of course, years later, he admitted that is one of the shootings that he did.
You were the second, I just mentioned, you were the second group of victims, you and Rosemary. Were there witnesses
Yes.
to your attack? And what was that description of?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that I, you know, of all the victims that survived, I'm the only one that has, you know, pursued this case. And there's the least amount of information on my case. So no, there was no eyewitnesses. It was 2 o'clock in the morning in a very residential neighborhood. I'm sure, I don't know for a fact, but I'm sure somebody was woken up by gunshot wounds. But like I said, Rosemary pulled the car away fast. I would think by the time someone got out of bed and went to the window, or, you know, the Volkswagen, Rosemary's Volkswagen, was probably gone already.
After your shooting, there's Donna DeMasi, 16-year-old, and Joanne Lomino, 18, in Queens, November 26, 1976. The description is man in 20s who asked for directions and pulled out a gun and fired. A blonde man ran with the gun. So even by that third set, we're already seeing these contradictory composites and descriptions, aren't we?
Oh, without a doubt. And that shooting actually did have some eyewitnesses. Obviously, both girls survived, although, you know, one was paralyzed, but they were both able to give police a description. And it was also two neighbors. I believe one was outside and on the sidewalk and saw this guy run with something in his left hand. He thought it was a gun, but he couldn't be sure. And then there was somebody else that looked out the window, and all four witnesses basically described the same person. The only difference was the part was on the left or the part was on the right, but the police sketches that they produced from these four witnesses are basically the same picture, except for for a left or right part.
Mm-hmm. And you say like DeMasi recovers, and unfortunately Lomino is a paraplegic. And then on January 30th, 1977, Christine Freund and her fiance John Deal, and this is in Queens, they didn't see their attacker. May 18th, 77, Virginia Voskarishian, 19, shot in the face. And then you say at that time, the city is in a state of panic by this time, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, like I said, there was no Son of Sam. But when the police put together and announced it's a serial killer, then basically all hell broke loose.
Mm-hmm. And early on, you were made to believe, or you believed somehow, that because you had long hair, tell us what you think, why you were shot.
Yeah, I guess later in that year, it kind of came. They said, well, you know, it's mostly brown, you know, girls with long brown hair, and I did have long brown hair, and I was in the passenger seat. So, you know, it was pretty, I don't know, pretty much everyone agreed I was probably shot, being mistaken for a female.
Now, you include, of course, about the next layer of this, or the next twist to this incredible story, is when the .44 caliber killer writes a letter to the New York Daily News reporter Jimmy Breslin, and with the taunting message, and the blood and family, darkness and death, absolute depravity, .44. Hello from the gutters of New York. Well, people are familiar with that. And he provides the names, I guess a variety of names, Duke of Death, the Wicked King Wicker, the 22 Disciples of Hell, which we will be exploring, John Wheaties, Rapist and Suffocator of Young Girls. So through all of this, and then eventually people know the story of the parking ticket and the woman that observes Berkowitz, and so the unraveling, and then he's arrested. And now when that arrest, obviously, tell us how you feel, but then how long is it before, how many years, or how long is it before you hear, or tell us about how you hear about some alternate story to the one that Berkowitz and the media especially has put out?
Yeah, I just to be clear, when this happened, when these shootings happened, I was getting my information, except for the two visits from the NYPD detectives. I was getting all my information, at, like everyone else, from the newspapers.
Right.
I had no reason to believe anything else was going on. How would I know? The story of thinking there might be other people involved was a very slow evolving story. And the first incident was January 1980, when I went with my lawyer for a civil case against David Berkowitz. And basically, we were there to all the victims and lawyers were there to determine what percentage each person would get based on their injury. And of course, the money they were talking about was just in case a movie was made or a book was written by this lawyer, Harry Lipsig, who was now deceased, but he was a pretty famous lawyer in New York City. He kept yelling at the judge. He said, "There's other people involved," and I had no idea what he was talking about. So I asked my lawyer, and he said, "Oh," he goes, "you know, Harry thinks there was a conspiracy and there was other shooters." I'm like, "Oh, really? I didn't know that." So that was 1980. Along about 1990-91, I met a retired New York City ballistics detective. Actually, I'm jumping ahead. The next step in this is reading Maury Terry's book in 1987, where Maury lays out this conspiracy that other people were involved. And again, as you mentioned earlier, 22 disciples of hell. So, of course, I was fascinated, and I'm like, wow. And I thought about the court in 1980. I'm like, well, maybe there is something to this. The third piece was when I met the retired ballistics detective, and he told me flat out that he worked on my case, and he, in the report, he wrote that either a woman or a 90-pound weakling fired the shots. He also told me that the file, my ballistics file, is no longer where it should be, and to this day, it's lost forever. So there was three pieces of information that led me to this. And, of course, the last and final piece to convince me was a TV interview that Maury Terry did with David Berkowitz. And he actually says, "Did you shoot Carl DeNiro?" And Berkowitz says, "No." "Do you know who did?" "Yes." And, it was a female, but he wouldn't give her name. So those four pieces of information, sealed it for me.
Yeah, certainly. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. FabFitFun Spring Box is centered around the theme Grow Forth, supporting self-care and self-growth in the new season ahead. My wife Lisa and I are planning to grow forth into the spring season by reconnecting with old friends, and getting back into hobbies and activities that we can plan to do outside. My wife Lisa was excited to get her FabFitFun Spring Box and wanting to get a head start this year on our garden, so she was anxious to get her LED indoor planter by Short Stories and get started planting seeds indoors for our garden this summer. Lisa loves all the FabFitFun items relating to skincare, like Grown Alchemist body cream with mandarin and rosemary leaf, and Josie Moran 100% pure argan oil. Lisa loved her Super Eye Serum by Verso with Retinol 8 and Pure Iconic Glow Moisturizing Face and Body Dry Oil. Lisa literally relies on FabFitFun and all the marvelous health and beauty products they deliver right to our door. 20 female-founded brands are in the spring box this season. You can choose from a wide variety of products when you order. Receive seasonal must-haves without leaving home. This FabFitFun spring box is still exciting for Lisa to receive, even after receiving FabFitFun boxes for almost 4 years. Lisa tells everyone she encounters about the amazing products and the incredible value and the perks of membership. Order your spring box today. Sign up now so you can snag amazing products like the LED Indoor Planner by Short Stories or Verso Super Eye Serum when you customize. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Now, Carl, we were just talking about this incredible moment when you realize there is much more to the story, and that's an incredible understatement. So how is it that you hook up with Maury Terry?
So, yeah, like I said, I read Maury's book. I didn't know him. I watched him on TV on Inside Edition and his jailhouse interviews with Berkowitz. And eventually I got a call from Geraldo Rivera to be a guest on his show. And at the time I worked in Manhattan, and they asked me, would you mind going up to 57th Street and going to this restaurant called Kennedy's, and we'll have a car waiting for you, you and Maury Terry. So I went to Kennedy's. I was introduced to Maury by the bartender, and we decided to forego dinner and decided to have a few drinks at the bar and talk about the Son of Sam. By the time the limo arrived, we were like best friends. And that was the beginning of my relationship with Maury.
Yeah, incredible. From the information, and Maury Terry manages, obviously, to speak to Berkowitz. So what do you find out early on in terms of this different narrative about who shot who and what is all involved here?
Yeah. So, you know, by the time I met Maury, and these different facts that I have found over the years, proving to me that more than one person was involved, that was just like the springboard to continue investigating. Now, up to this point, I wasn't investigating anything. The internet was relatively new, and believe it or not, in 1994, there really wasn't that much that you could Google, but there was stuff there, and obviously there's a lot more now. Maury was, old school, and old school investigative reporter, and he had a typewriter, an IBM Selectric, and he typed away, and he had sources, and he'd go to Kennedy's and talk, police officials and what have you. So I was because of my work, I was familiar with the internet, and I had a computer at home, and I offered to help him, because I was shocked that he was able to put this book together and do all his research with no internet. So he started feeding me. He didn't even have a cell phone, just by the way. He started feeding me through phone calls, like names or addresses, and says, look this up. But he wouldn't really tell me what I was looking up. It would just be, look up Joe Blow and tell me what you could find about him. So I said, there's a million Joe Blows. You got to be more specific. He goes, well, Joe Blow on City Island. All right, that's better. And it was kind of fun, I'll be honest with you. And I got to the point where I became pretty good at it, as for Maury anyway. And that's, and I continued doing that for Maury. I'm sure he had other people helping him out. But I continued doing research, internet research for him until pretty much to the day he died in 2015.
In this investigation that he undertook and you undertook and furthered as well, what we have mentioned 22 disciples, but what is it that Berkowitz had said, and what is it that in your investigation you tried to corroborate? And you said that in the introduction and throughout, you talk about officially people will say on the record, but off the record, you have spoken to many law enforcement people who have said and supported the ideas that not only Maury Terry espoused in his book, The Ultimate Evil, but supporting the ideas and the suspicions that you had.
That's very true. Of course, you know, I guess the two biggest spokespeople for law enforcement in this case was Joe Borelli, who was the captain who actually the first letter that was the first Son of Sam letter was actually addressed to Joe Borelli, and the other person was Coffey. Joe was, you know, he was quite a character, and he liked to be on TV, and, you know, and he was really like the mouthpiece, and he just towed the line that, you know, Maury Terry's, you know, crazy, and anyone who believes in conspiracy is, you know, is crazy, and we got our man, and that's the end of the story. Joe, if you approach him, Joe Borelli, he will basically tell you the same thing, but he kind of kept you know, a low profile. So I would go on shows like in the mid 90s, and they would have me explaining my story. Sometimes Maury would be with me explaining the same thing much more eloquently than I. And then they'd have Joe Coffey on, saying these two guys are morons, and it got to the point where I said I'll never do another interview if Joe Coffey's involved, because here's the guy, you know, he's a victim, everyone feels bad, but he openly admits he didn't see anything, and there's Joe Coffey, a highly decorated NYPD detective, who are you going to believe? And sure. So, you know, every time we took a step forward, Joe Coffey would come on TV and take us two steps back, and it was extremely frustrating. Yeah. And I get it. You know, I don't want people to think I'm a cop basher, because I'm not. And I actually met Marlon Hopkins, 5 years ago. And I told him, I said, you know, you did your job. He was, you know, I said, your job is to arrest, you know, the suspect. And you did. I said, what my beef is, you know, 5 years, 6 years, 10 years after. I'm sorry. I thought I turned this off. You know, 10 years when all this new information came out, the NYPD didn't reopen the case and investigate, as crazy it might sound to Joe Coffey, investigate all these facts that Maury and other people have brought forward. I mean, it wasn't, I think it was 1979, 1980, that the Queens DA, John Santucci, actually reopened the case based on additional information. Unfortunately, it was shut down 6 weeks later. I'm told that it was shut down by the mayor's office. That I'm not, you know, that's just what I heard. I don't know how true that is, but it did get shut down real quick. And John Santucci's on record saying, you know, I believe that David Berkowitz did not act alone.
Right.
You know,
well,
so it's kind of incredible that a DA would say that, and then 30 years later, no one, you know, it still hasn't looked at the information.
Well, to be fair, and I mean, I'm not to be fair, but to understand, I think, and to it, the killing seemingly stopped and officially in people's minds, and you
yes.
would just probably disagree with that, but officially it looked like they stopped, and Berkowitz had seemingly confessed. And there was a lot of pressure on police and politicians, and this guy had, you know, Son of Sam entity had paralyzed the city.
Yes, without a doubt, and I actually cut myself off because I wanted to continue my thought about the law enforcement. They were in a really bad position, you know. I mean, the serial killers were relatively a new phenomena. They had very little to go on. I think they did their best. You know, I have no qualms with that. I do have a little bit of a qualm of, you know, when you're given new information, you don't follow up on it. But with that being said, you know, David Berkowitz was no help either, because he changed his story from saying I did everything and was a talking dog to there is no talking dog, but there is a satanic cult, to I did two of the killings, but I didn't do the other, but I was there at all of them. He kind of muddied the waters, which I'm assuming he did that by design. You know, so it didn't help our case, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
The shooting stopping, that I always find that interesting, and you know, because that's I get that a lot. Like, you know, well, how can you say that the shooting stopped? Well, think about it. If regardless if it's one person or five people using the same gun or five different guns that are all the, you know, similar,
right.
If they arrest a guy and he's in jail for 450 years, why in God's name would you pick up another .44 caliber and shoot somebody? Because now you just got the police back on your tail. So,
yeah.
You know, but the killings did continue. They just used ways of getting rid of people.
Well, you explain in this as well, because Berkowitz, you know, tells people about and Maury Terry and in interviews that he explains the satanic cult. So I'll get you to explain what he says about the satanic cult and what his role was in that cult and what happened that particular day involving the parking ticket and what Berkowitz said about this Untermeyer Park and its role.
Right. So that's a lot to unpack, but I will do my best. You know, the day of the last shooting, the Stacy Moskowitz, Robert Violante shooting, as we all know, Berkowitz, I don't know, 10 minutes, a half hour, 20 minutes before the shots were fired, got a parking ticket in front of a fire hydrant. At that point, supposedly he tried to call the whole thing off, and he was like outvoted, and because of the parking ticket, he became the fall guy. I think this is an assumption on my part, but I get a feeling that John Carr was originally the fall guy. And the reason I say that is, the letter that you mentioned earlier, where the writer wrote John Wheaties, you know, rapist and suffocator of young girls. Well,
right.
his name, he was nicknamed Wheaties, and I believe it's because his dad owned an answering service, and his sister, whose name is Wheat, the dad gave him one line to share. So in the directory, you know, back in the days when we had phone books, it said John Wheat. And again, this is an assumption on my part. I got a feeling his buddies kind of like made fun of him. You know, oh, John Wheat, that, you know, that's a girl's name, you know. And and it kind of became his nickname, John Wheaties. He was well known in Yonkers as John Wheaties. So that's my assumption that he was the original fall guy. But you know, that's the only explanation I can think of why his name would be in that letter. But
now, in your particular case, you mentioned, and without explanation, so I'm going to ask for that explanation. When you talked to that detective and he said the person that shot you was either a woman or a 90-pound weakling. Now, why did he say that? And then what did you find in terms of what Berkowitz had said about who shot you?
Right. So, I didn't really follow up correctly when the detective told me that, because I know nothing about ballistics, but I should have asked the question, well, how did you determine that? Because a lot of law enforcement people I've spoken to says, what does that mean? That doesn't even make any sense. You know, you can't tell from ballistics, you know, who fired the gun. And so I you know, unfortunately this fellow passed away, so I can't ask him, but I have talked to other ballistics experts, and their assumption is the fact that I'm still alive is he drew that conclusion because of the wildness of the shooting and the recoil of a 44 caliber.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, and if you look at the other shootings, some of them are, I don't know what's the correct way to say it, but they're, you know, whoever pulled the trigger killed people, and there was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And other shootings were, like mine, thankfully, were just not that accurate.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you find in terms of what Berkowitz said, who shot you, just to, again, eerily support what this detective had assumed?
Right. So, you know, a couple of years after I found this information out from the ballistics expert, I see Berkowitz on TV saying that a woman shot Carl DeNiro. So at the time, Maury was communicating with Berkowitz on a regular basis, sometimes through phone calls, but mostly snail mail. And it was very long and tedious because, you know, Maury would write a 3-page letter and mail it, and he might not get a response for 3 or 4 months. So this went on for years. I started communicating with Berkowitz not too long ago with that question. And, unfortunately, he has not told me, but I do hold out hope that I am going to get an answer. But what we shall see about that.
Tell our audience about this conspiracy, what Berkowitz and what Maury Terry believed. Well, not what Berkowitz believed, what Maury Terry believed, what you believe, based on what Berkowitz had said and the investigation that you undertook. What is this cult and what was its goal? Who are some of the members? There are names in this book. There are pseudonyms, but there are names in this book. Tell us what this cult was.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And I will give you the best answer I have, which is, in my opinion, not a complete answer. But to answer the question, I have to go back to mention retired detective Jim Rothstein. He was in charge of dealing with the runaways that was rampant on 42nd Street in Manhattan. And they actually called it the Minnesota Strip because a lot of the young people, mostly girls, but boys too, you know, would hop on a bus and go to Port Authority, and the pimps would, would prey on them. And basically, you know, a lot of them came to New York with, you know, $5 in their pocket and a knapsack. And, you know, the pimps would, give him a room to stay in, give him food, eventually drugs, and next thing you know, they're prostitutes. So Jim Rothstein started this in the late 60s, and one of his informants brings him up to Untermeyer Park in Yonkers and says this, you know, there's not only is there child prostitution and trafficking going on, there's also a satanic cult in the park that, you know, uses the park. Now you have to realize this is 7 years before 7 years before the Son of Sam shootings. And Jim Rothstein learned about the Process Church, who was part of this. I am not saying the Process Church is a satanic cult, but I think we can all agree bad people hang out with bad people. So there's a lot of intermingling right. of groups. Unlike Maury originally said that the Process Church, you know, was the impetus behind the Son of Sam, I don't buy that. I think some offshoot, you know, some members and an offshoot of the Process Church were involved, but none of them are good people anyway. It's one other thing I want to mention is, and this is not to disparage the residents of Yonkers, New York, but I have a few friends that live there now, and everyone in Yonkers knows that Untermeyer Park has been used, I guess like any other park in the country. You know, teenagers go there to smoke pot, drink beer, have keg parties, and some other nefarious groups use the park for whatever. There's certainly proof that there's some satanic worshiping going on, because there was photos that you can be found in The Ultimate Evil, Maury's book, that there's photos of you know, an altar with a pentagram. And you listen to Jim Rothstein, and all this stuff really happened. Mm-hmm. To answer the final part of this is, what was their purpose? I really don't know. The way I know it, it was kind of almost like a multi-layer corporation, and at the bottom was the 22 Disciples of Hell, which Berkowitz was one of. And like any other cult, I think cult leaders will reach out to the disenfranchised, offer girls, whatever you're into, girls, boys, drugs, parties, to do their bidding. And what is their bidding? Well, we pretty much know it has a lot to do with drugs. And when I say drugs, I mean large quantities of drugs, and procuring boys for the rich and famous. I know that's kind of a far cry from Talking Dogs and David Berkowitz, but in light of what people have been reading in the last, 7 or 8 years, it certainly fits in. It's a lot more believable today than it was 30 years ago, because the general public, just poo-pooed everything. You know, they even made up a name, Satanic Panic. There was no panic. It really was there, But it's the old CIA thing, misinformation and disinformation to confuse everyone and to make everyone that believes in it a tinfoil conspiracist.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. You talk about, too, that this is not... there are certainly things that you share with Maury Terry, but this is different from some of the things that he said. And in The Ultimate Evil, too, you say that it's brilliant three quarters of the way through. But when you get to the California connections and Manson, that lost you, and it lost credibility with a lot of people, you say, as well. With this book, despite your lack of getting real answers from Berkowitz, it's very interesting. You provide all of that. You provide all the sketches that were involved, and it's dramatic. You say that the sketches looking like one of the cars, I believe, John
yes.
Carr, I believe. The thing is that you also include the correspondence with Berkowitz, and you asked him nicely and approached him gingerly, and then you approached him again and tried to ask him questions, and you're hoping for, he said, be patient, but you really didn't get much from David Berkowitz, unfortunately, did you?
I did not, and it's kind of funny because I heard through an intermediary that he wanted to talk to me, and I batted the idea around quite a while. Actually, at one point, Maury had set up an interview that I was going to do with Berkowitz, Maury being the moderator, and we had everything set up, and then about a week before, Berkowitz backed off, and that was it. I got a feeling that there's probably going to be some fence mending. I'm certainly not going to apologize, but I can't believe that he would be thrilled that I wrote a book. But on the other hand, the name of the book is The Truth About Why I Wasn't Shot by David Berkowitz.
Exactly.
I think I should get some credit for that in Berkowitz's mind. So we shall see.
Yeah.
What his reaction is, because as you pointed out in one of the letters, he did say, just be patient. I take hope from that I'm not really sure what it means, but I am a patient guy. I've been waiting 45 years, so I can wait another 10 or 15. So who knows? Maybe he's going to wait for his deathbed. I don't know.
You say, again, a lot of things that you might not be 100% sure about certain things, but you are certain that he did not shoot you. David Berkowitz did not shoot you. But you create and have created a compelling story here to say that there's much more than the official story, and there's much more that anyone would imagine. And it comes right from somebody that actually lived through this, and you're still living this to this day, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. It's not, I have gone on with my life. It was never all consuming, if you will. But it's never been far from my mind. And of course, you know, just in my personal life, people know me and they find out that I was a victim of Son of Sam. You get that, I hate to use the word celebrity because I'm certainly not a celebrity, but people, always wanted, like, you know, what did it feel like? What happened? So even if I wanted to forget about it, I would never be able to for more than a week or two.
And
I'm not complaining. Don't get me wrong.
And I think that's going to be more the case with the release of this book. When was this book released? And this is a Wild Blue Press release. So just tell us when it was released and if you have a Facebook page or how they might find out more about this book.
Okay, so it was published by wildbluepress.com. And you could purchase the book through them or through Amazon. Of course, the name of the book is The Son of Sam and Me, The Truth About Why I Wasn't Shot by David Berkowitz, by Carl DeNaro and Brian Whitney. I don't have a website. Unfortunately, I was told the book was going to be published in April, and I'm working on a website. It's just not ready yet, but I have a very original name. It's called CarlDeNaro.com. That was a joke. But anyway, I'm hoping by, I don't know, two or three, by the end of March, I will have the website up, and it's got some additional photos that I didn't put in the book. I think they're kind of cool. Photos of the Volkswagen I was in. There is one in the book on the passenger side, and you can see the hole in the roof of the car. But I have some other photos, and also you'll be able to buy the book directly through me. Of course, I will sign it if you want it. And I'm also going to put my daughter's short film on the website for sale. It's actually I'm prejudiced. I think it's a compelling 16-minute film, and it basically covers the night I was shot until the day March 10th when they announced that the serial killer. So that will be available in a few weeks. Yes.
You talked about too that you talk about this secure website, but you say for now your email. Can I give out your email as you do in the book?
Yes. I'm sorry, because that's a new email. Is that the Gmail?
Yeah.
Yes, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just haven't used it yet.
This investigation is still not over for you. So the email is Carl De Niro, Son of Sam Survivor, at gmail.com. So thank you very much, Carl De Niro, the Son of Sam and Me, the truth about why I wasn't shot by David Berkowitz. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening. Thank you so much,
you too,
Carl.
Thanks, Dan. All right.
Thank you.
All
good
right.
Night.
Bye-bye. Good night.